Today, I want to talk about large-scale industrialization and workers. Let me say a couple things, a couple general points that are important. Two things at the beginning. First of all, everywhere, and particularly in the case of France, the Industrial Revolution was first and foremost a continuation of forms of production that were already there. That we've overemphasized the kind of technological advances, the super inventions of the 18th century in the textile industry, and that even in Britain, and some of you have heard me say this in the context of another course, traditional ways of producing things, artisanal and domestic industry involving women doing outwork or domestic industry was essential to the process. The second Industrial Revolution really depends on when you want to start it up, really from the mid-1850s on, is more what the classical kind of way that we've come to consider large-scale industrialization, that is with, you know, electricity and steel in the other order, and large-scale units of production. So that's really the first point. And the second point is that for a very long time, people who did economic history, often whom were historians or were economists, tended to see Britain as this sort of classic case of large-scale industrialization, and even used the most unfortunate word, retarded, when describing large-scale French industrialization. And the reasons they kind of blundered into that kind of analysis that really missed the point is that if you added up, you know, the number of factories with X number of workers, or if you added up the number of steam engines, that France lagged behind Britain. But until the mid-19th century, France is the second largest industrial economy in the world, and then gradually overtaken by Germany, and then eventually lapped by the United States. One of the reasons why these economic historians argue that France couldn't become the major industrial leader was that the capital formation was less easily achieved in France because the banking and insurance facilities were not that, to be sure, of the equal of Great Britain. Also, one of the advantages that England had in large-scale industrialization was its geography. That you had one of the reasons why the first railroad in the world in about 1827, no, earlier than that, actually, about 1819, I guess it is, was in England, north of here, is that it was carrying coal down to the sea. And there's nowhere in England that's more than 75 miles away from the ocean. In France, you had the kinds of mine deposits that are so important in the Germinal. You've got them in the Nord here. You've got them in Alsace. Of course, that's disappeared. You have them down in the Aviron, in Decazeville, and you have them here and there in other places, particularly around Saint-Étienne. But they are far from, it's very difficult to transport coal, and so that was really kind of the problem. But if you look at large-scale industrialization in France, it still proceeds rather dramatically, and in the 18, but in the French way, still involving artisanal production, craft production in Paris and in other cities, and still involving, until quite late in the century, rural industry. You know, as a matter of fact, if we just take an example that I always use because I love the place. If you take Reims, R-E-I-M-S, here, industrial production was a major textile center. You think of it as being an ecclesiastical center because the coronation of the kings and all that business, and the magnificent cathedral rebuilt by the Americans after World War I, and the Basilica of Saint-Remy. But in the 1840s and 50s, 1830s and 40s, you still had all sorts of rural industry that sort of putting out work into the countryside, done largely by women. And then gradually you have the growth of large-scale industrial production in the context of factories. But well into the 1870s, you still had something like 75,000 embroiderers, mostly women again, living in the hinterland of Nancy. And in 1871, the average unit of production in Paris, and Paris was the region, was the biggest industrial center of France, had only seven people working in it. So if you're looking for huge sweatshops, huge factories that you would find in Manchester and Sheffield and places like that, they were pretty rare in France, and indeed some of the biggest units of production were mines. By the way, Germinal is really about the Anzin mines, and they are in the north of France, and Anzin is right a couple kilometers northwest of Valenciennes, so right near the Belgian border. But over the long run, that and into this course, the 1850s and 60s, which is before this course, but the large-scale industrialization is develops more and more in France. And as in Britain, and as in other places, in order to have investment in industry, you have to have capital. You have to have a sort of surplus of capital, and you have to have a way of feeding a growing population, only very slowly in the case of France, as you know. And so there is an increase in production and rural production that makes this possible, a sort of an agricultural a revolution that takes place. That it certainly has, as we'll see in a week or so, big problems with the phylloxera epidemic killing off the vineyards of France, which is so important to agricultural production. But you have to eat as well as drink, and so there is an increase in production of agriculture all over the place. And so this is very important. And just another point, until 10 years ago, people still talked about the Long Depression. And that was a very unfortunate term because it gave the sense that the depression that gripped Europe between 1873, 1874, and the mid-1890s was in any way comparable to the Great Depression that in industrialized countries and in not-so-industrialized countries, but the Industrial Depression from 1929. In the case of the U.S. doesn't really get out of it until the massive arms production following Pearl Harbor in World War II. It's a depression. It's characterized by low prices. You don't have these big sort of catastrophic dips, but it's a depression which undercuts the economy in some way, and particularly hurts rural people because the prices of agricultural goods are so low. But nonetheless, this is not an economics course, but it's good to have a few figures nonetheless. If you look here, the percentage of the population working in industry in France in 1876 is 27.6% of the population. And in 1896, 20 years later, is 29.2%. So, I mean, it's quite clear, France is still a peasant society, even though many people have foots in both worlds. Miners, for example, working in mines in the south of France in a place called Carmaux, which I'll come back to in a while, a small town in the town, they were both miners and agricultural, they're farmers and day laborers, and it's the same thing in other mines of Decazeville. But still, the number of people whose principal activity is industry increases. And France also urbanizes at the same time. Now, the percentage of the population in 1872 that are urban is 21%, 21.1% or something like that. In 1901, it's 40.9%. Now, you're going to think, boy, France is really urbanized. But that's completely misleading because to be urban in France, as of the census of 1841, you had to have 2,000 people, and that's all. And the example I always give is there are 2,000 people outside the Meriden Mall when it opens sometimes, or the Boston Post Road Mall. I mean, 2,000 people does not seem like a major urban agglomeration. So France still is, the level of urbanization is not comparable to that of the Prussian Rhineland before 1871 or Germany afterward, or the United States. If you go to the Naugatuck Valley and the sort of Rust Belt there, I mean, the United States urbanizes, the eastern United States urbanizes very rapidly. I mean, we'll come back to this when I talk about cities, but You know, France does have large cities, above all Paris, but it is primarily an urbanization of very small places of what in French and in English, the same word, you would call bourg, B-O-U-R-G-S, which are market towns, essentially, so small towns. So we're still dealing with a society in which production is overwhelmingly rural, but in which you know, France is becoming a major kind of industrial producing country. And one of the things that increases the number of people, I mean, the rate of urbanization really is a growth in the proportional number of people living in whatever you define as cities, is le grand départ, or the big departure, as rural people leave the countryside and move into cities. And this is one of the great social happenings of this entire period. And I probably used this statistic for, if I didn't, I should have, and I'll use it again, that in 1851, two-thirds of all the departments or départements in France had a larger population in 1851 than they did in 1939. So that's really incredible. So you have really huge growth in the industrial north, and that's what you've been reading about, the Nord, that department, N-O-R-D, and in other areas with a big major center, for example, Toulouse, which is, you know, the fourth or fifth largest city at that time, way in the south, one of France's most wonderful cities. So you have departments like that that are growing in population because of people leaving the mountains, people leaving areas of central France that simply aren't rentable. I mean, you can't make enough money to survive, particularly during an agricultural depression. And the wine disease, we talk about a catastrophe, the wine disease, you know, knocks out much, you know, production. I mean, it knocks out the way people live. And in, you know, the part in south, and down in this part of France, you already had a huge blow to the rural economy with another disease that comes along and wipes out, or at least severely constrains, the silk industry, the raw silk industry. So people get up and leave, and they go, they enter these new jobs like teaching or clerking or working in railroad stations, and that transforms the way people live. And so, you know, you have to sort of see all of these things, the kind of the flow of people back and forth, and even some flows that end. I mean, there was since the 16th century this pattern of seasonal migration of men, only men, walking every year all the way from this part of central France to Paris to Rouen to other northern cities to work in the construction industry. They started that in the 16th century, and they walk every March, and then they come back every November. And so most babies, if all goes normally, are born within a 3 month period. But a huge percentage of the male workforce walks in lines of two all the way to Paris. You also have these patterns from the Pyrenees down to Barcelona, and from the Alps down to Milan, or down to Lyon, those regions too. And one of the things that happens in this course is that seasonal migration stops, and those people basically become seasonal migrants, and the areas from which they came are depopulated. I mean, depopulation is one of the most amazing things about rural France, and that's what has been going. Well, the last 10 years has been a rediscovery of the countryside, and a lot of people retire there, and you have the phenomenon of what you call village dortoir, or sort of dormitory villages where people live when they're working in the city. But one of the astonishing things about seeing all the people killed, going and seeing the war monuments, particularly in the Massif Central or places like that, is that, you know, when you see all these dead people, you see you can imagine their faces, and you see all their names on these huge plaques, you know, 80, 90, 100, and they're just in these little teeny, you know, towns in which the countryside has been sort of abandoned and now maybe bought up by the British, but as in many places. But so the grand départ, the big departure for urban areas and new jobs is part of this entire scene as well. So where is industrial production in the time we're talking about in France? Well, where's my little jiffy statistic? But in the north, that is certainly the case. 62.1% of the population of people in the Nord that you're reading about, or maybe even finished in this one, have already finished this wonderful novel, are workers. So it's the pure, so the proletarian département along with the Pas-de-Calais next to it. And the first sort of conurbation, a conurbation is cities that grow so rapidly, they all come together, like become one city, is Lille, which is all, had been there for centuries and centuries, and then Roubaix and Tourcoing, which just grow up, they're little Manchesters in France. You find the same thing around Saint-Étienne. So big, heavy mining and textile industry in this part of France, for sure. And the other big industrial region, of course, I mean the biggest, is the Paris region. But the Paris region, you're still producing these articles of Paris. That's what they call them, les articles de Paris, which are things like wallets and shoes and fine quality goods that are part of the industrial pride of France. I mean, when they had these big expositions in Victorian England, there'd all be these mass-produced things in England that William Morris, sort of sponsor of arts and craft movement, said it was the age of the shoddy. And the French would always proudly say, we don't turn out this Victorian kind of junk. We make products of quality. So you have these fine clothes still being made by, put together by single women or single men. I don't know if they're married or not, but working by themselves at home, that are part of the artisanal structure of Paris. Where if you went into the hinterland of Paris or into the industrial suburbs, there you have the dirty industries, soap production, chemical production that people don't want in the city, and the city values are so high that if you want space, you're going to build them outside. More about that when I talk about Paris. And then you have Lyon, and Lyon was the silk workers' capital of the world in terms of production. And if you want to find one, if you're going to go to one city and see where every layer of architecture, every layer of architecture representing the past is there. I mean, Lyon is the place to go, because there you've got Gallo-Roman ruins, you've got fabulous medieval neighborhood, on the right bank of the Saône River. You have Renaissance quarters that are fabulous. You have the best 17th century, really, apartment buildings that are left anywhere in France. You have the 18th century sort of classic, the Place Bellecour. And you have this 19th century industrial suburb right on the hill called the Croix Rousse, where all the buildings have real tall roofs in order to accommodate these big silk looms, which are called jacquards. But you obviously don't have to remember that. But the point is that this becomes a big industrial center, and that even as late as the 1860s, you still had merchant capitalists putting work back out into the countryside in order to take advantage of what? Of cheap female labor. Women make one half of what men do in any trade in Europe, any occupation throughout the 19th century and well into the 20th century. You have other artisanal kind of producing towns. You have, Toulouse is a big artisanal center. Marseille produces soap. I mean, I could go through the whole map, but I'm not going to do that. You have old textile towns that are still producing, churning out lots of things like Rouen, which is one of my favorite towns, in Normandy, where I teach every year, a course that we jam into 2 weeks, and Troyes and places like that. But these places are rather spread apart. You've got your basic shipbuilding places like Saint-Nazaire, et cetera, et cetera. So though not gifted by having primary resources near major waterways, with the exception of the Loire River, you still have this transformation of the economy. But there is industrial production of some kind almost anywhere that you could go. And then you have very specialized cases like Limoges, which is famous for its porcelain. Maybe more about that later. Why is it famous for its porcelain? Because there's a clay that you make porcelain out of called kaolin, which was a Chinese term that is available there. And so that's why Haviland porcelain, which no longer exists, incredibly enough, Avilon, who is an American. I said that before, but it doesn't exist. They're closing their doors, and there's only one really major producer left. But these were part of the Industrial Revolution in La Belle France. And because it has now been annexed by Germany, that is not now, but in the 1870s, in 1871, I didn't talk about all the textile production in Alsace, but there's lots of textile production there. And as everywhere, it's the textile production that is the cutting edge, the leading edge of the Industrial Revolution, followed by metallurgical production. And as in the case of of Britain that is the trains help encourage investment because people can see trains, they can ride trains, and they look like something that's going to lead France into this new, brave new industrial world, and so that helps accentuate the number of people who have something to invest, investing in railroads. As a matter of fact, one of the things that probably hurts French industry during exactly the period we're talking about, that is the 1870s, 80s, and the early 1890s, is the fact that French capitalists begin investing in railroads, but in other places, in Italy, in Russia, and in Spain, where the railroads are, to a great extent, built by French capital. So then you've got people who are from English economists saying, oh, well, they'll never catch up with us because the peasants all hide their money under their beds or bury them in the gardens, or people that have capital to invest are investing the money in these other railroads. Now, what about women in all of this? The role of women in Industrial Revolution is obviously crucial in the case of France and in the case of Sheffield, around Sheffield or Birmingham in England. The role of women in domestic industry or their finishing products was extremely important and extremely persistent. The Industrial Revolution, even the Second Industrial Revolution, the story is more continuities than dramatic changes in the production in the role of women in the Industrial Revolution. I mean, women had always worked in textile production, but they'd worked by themselves, in the Vendée or anywhere in Lorraine or almost anywhere back for centuries, and they still do. We've exaggerated the separation of work and home in the role of women in the Industrial Revolution, because if you look at Paris in the 1890s, I have a former graduate student, Judy Coffin, who has a wonderful book on the sewing machine and its role in all of this. If you look at industrial production of these fine garments and handbags that are made in Paris, many of them in the garment industry, the garment district of Paris, which is right in the center of Paris on the right bank around a street called Sentier, are done by single women working in the very top floors by themselves and working for a merchant capitalist, just as their predecessors had done two centuries before that. And so those continuities are still very important. But to be sure, in the more sort of classic or the usual kind of thing you hear, I'll make in a while, to be sure they gradually move into factory production. But what does not change is, another thing that does not change is the role of women in the managing of the household economy. Because women have to somehow piece together enough work, enough income from their children and from their husbands or partners in order to keep the family going. And women's role in the industrial or in the household economy is still extraordinarily important. Also, some aspects of women work that is not industrial does not change. In England, in Great Britain, but let's say England, in 1850 and again in 1880, the largest two female occupations are textile operatives, factory workers, and domestics. And in France, that's the same case too. And one of the things that single women do who come into Paris or Lyon or Strasbourg or whatever to try to get a job is they place themselves in domestic service. And of course, their conditions of work are lamentable. And there's a whole range of literature, about what happens to them. And of course, some of the most spectacular cases of things going wrong are the ones that you hear about from social commentators at that time, which is the single domestic service gets impregnated by the aggressive older son or younger son of the boss, and then the minute she is pregnant, she is out of there, and then that is a fairly quick road in many cases of many rural people to if you're pregnant, you aren't going to get hired. Who's going to hire you? So then what happens to the baby? In France, anywhere, infanticide or abandonment in the foundling homes. What they did, and so in order to cut down the infanticide rate, they create this thing, and it still was debated again about 3 months ago in Rome. They create these things called tours. These things that turn, and they're like machines that they used to have in the ill-fated machine city, which some of you don't remember, where you put in your money, and if you get lucky, you know, the product will actually come back towards you. And what happens there is you ring the little bell, and this little thing turns, and you put the baby in there, and then some nice person keeps the baby, because otherwise you just abandon the baby, and the baby dies. And the number of infanticides every day was tragic. And once you got into, if you were a baby, and you get into one of these foundling homes, your chances of survival are very thin. In every large foundling home, really through the 1870s, the number of people, of babies who die is one-third every year. So that's another reason, by the way, why French cities, more people die in French cities than are born in French cities through much of the century, because of the huge rates of child abandonment and infanticides. So it's a most unfortunate scene. And then what happens after Mother X has her baby, abandons her baby, and sadly, maybe in 10% of the cases, kills her baby, is that the road to prostitution is a rather quick one coming along, or try to get back into domestic service. But for most women, things go better than that, though they never go splendidly, because they're never going to get earn what males work earn, and they're the last hired and the first fired right along. And then you had this other thing that happens, is that the socialists are quite concerned with what happens to women's wages, and the unions are quite concerned with what happens to women's wages, but they're not very concerned about whether they have the right to vote. Why? Because the socialists are afraid that because women, as I said before, are more apt to go to church than men, by far, then and now, that they will vote the way the priest tells them in the confessional. So the socialists do not support the right of women to vote. And women don't vote in France. They don't get the right to vote after World War I, despite all the sacrifices. They get the right to vote in Britain. They don't get the right to vote in France until after World War II. So what changes, to keep your eye on the big picture, is that domestic industry gradually implodes into these cities, into factories on the edge of French cities, big and small, but that what women do doesn't change. They're still doing domestic industry. They're still doing they're still doing textile work. They're not doing domestic industry. I take that back. They are doing textile industry work, but increasingly in factories, which is the classic portrayal of the Industrial Revolution. And so the classic portrayal ends up being right, but only rather gradually in France over a very long period of time. Or take Catherine, one of the more engaging figures in modern French literature, I think it's fair to say. Her experience is perfectly normal. It's sad, it's pathetic, but it's very normal. Give you an example. This is, we live about 2.5 hours from Saint-Étienne, and I hardly ever go to Saint-Étienne. I go to their work once in a while in the archives, but not that often. Nor do I follow Les Verts, which is their famous soccer team. But there's still an expression that people use there. If a child screws up, does something, you're 8 or 9 years old, and you do something your parents tell you not to do, and you do it anyway, they'll say something like, deux semaines sous une benne, two weeks under a benne is a kind of a wagon that's used to haul coal. And what children did in factories and in mines is, because they're small, you can put them under one of these wagons and they help move it along the tracks. That would be a lot of fun, wouldn't it? Because they have little shoulders, but strong shoulders. Or fixing machines in factories with their little fingers, which would get chopped off. They're so careless, said a British manufacturer, when a couple of them kept getting their fingers chopped off. A way of correcting, a child would say, 2 weeks, pushing that thing around and you won't screw up. You'll do what I tell you to do. You won't skip school. You'll go to school. and this sort of thing. So these expressions still linger. So child labor too, again, I mean, there is opposition to schooling from families who need that extra income or that extra labor of children in the farmyard or watching the sheep in the transhumance, moving the sheep into the mountain and all that. So these continuities and changes are extremely important. Now, I didn't, and I don't think I have time to do this now, but I'll do it sometime, talk about the decline of the French population, why France simply stops having children. I've talked a little bit about that, but I have to come back and do that again. I think I'll wait till we're talking about the origins of World War I, because that's when it really frightened people, because it didn't look like there'd be enough French to survive, to maybe fight a war against all those rapidly breeding Germans. And things weren't working there. So what I want to talk to about now is how workers viewed what was happening to them. And so there's really kind of three things I want to say. The first is that proletarianization is both, and this was a word that people used, is both an objective and a subjective concept. And the third is to talk about how workers viewed the factory and viewed their bosses. Because the period, particularly 1895 to 1907, has been called the heroic age of syndicalism, or union organization, and strikes in France. Now, proletarianization. We live in a country in which part of the canon has always been that that in America, if you work hard, you will always be rewarded at the end. And that the descriptions of the late 19th century is people working very hard and doing very well and moving into the middle and indeed upper classes and becoming very wealthy. Obviously, that's not the case. That the great exceptions were the one that people paid attention to. There is social mobility in France. There used to be all sorts of studies. That's what people did, not me, but in the 1970s about social mobility. But social mobility was extremely limited for people who were born into the working class. And in 1968, the riots, the La Révolution manquée. In 1968, one of the big issues that students your age had, and professors my age had, though I was your age then, or a little younger, I guess, was that you could work your ass off, and your chances of getting into a university weren't very good, because once you were born into, you know, the lower classes, the schools were schools of elites. That's what they were. And once you got through there, there was no guarantee you were going to get a job anywhere. And people were extremely mad and upset. And they blamed capitalism, they blamed the state, as people, their predecessors had in the 1890s. And so people who were born into, you know, a life of work, a life of hard, difficult work, that was one, you know, you were born into the jobs that you would get. And if I'll give you another Saint-Étienne example, because that's so important, Saint-Étienne, that there are lots of people who moved to Saint-Étienne, don't have to remember this, come from a very religious part of France called the Haute-Loire, of which the capital is Le Puy. And a lot of these people emptying out that department moved to Saint-Étienne. And they don't move, you know, some of them become teachers, some of them are going to get clerk's jobs if they're educated. But they don't do very well. And they live, there are periods where they're doing all right, and then they're let go, and then they're doing all right, and then they're let go. And it's just, the more you read about the 1880s and 90s and sort of memoirs of working people was just the difficulty of making things work from day to day, week to week, month to month, just getting by. And they learn to hate. I'm writing a book about a guy whom I'll tell you about someday who really, he said that love can make you hate. And he viewed all of this, and then he set out to destroy the state that he thought had made capitalism possible. But that's another story for another day. So, you know, there's this objective status of being, you know, you're a worker. That's what you do, and you're proud of it. And you wore blue as a color. You wore your blue, you know, frock or smock, whatever you call it. And you spoke a language in argot. Read you know, if you read L'Assommoir, you know, in French, I mean, it's a language that's extremely difficult to read because a lot of the expressions have disappeared. But it's a way of protecting your identity. It's like the way people talked in the suburbs, particularly in the 1980s, 1990s, en verlan. It's a kind of language, kind of a slang, of an argot that helps protect your identity, that you're proud of your identity. And you know, they were proud of being workers as well they should. But the subjective aspect is what people studied in the 1960s and 70s. And the term is class consciousness. And certainly there was an attempt to prove that all workers all over the place were class conscious. But that wasn't the case. People have other identities, collective identities. You can have multiple identities, family, religion, region, we've talked about this, village, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact remains that one of the reasons why there's so many strikes in France, as in other countries too, it has to do on one hand with unionization and the sympathetic role of left-wing politicians in supporting working class organization, but it has also as much to do with people coming to a sense that they are workers and are conscious of themselves as a class, and they view the state and the wealthy people as being contrary to their interests. Now, this starts in France, starts earlier among artisans in Britain, arguably in the 1790s. In France, it really starts in the 1830s. The word socialism is first used by a socialist in 1834, a guy called Pierre Leroux, who is a utopian socialist. Forget him, but he's an interesting guy. But it's at this point where artisans, not ordinary workers, but see themselves as a class apart, though at the beginning they don't want anything to do with these unskilled workers that they may work with in a factory. But they're dressed nicely. They wear corduroy suits. And these other workers, they don't dress like that, and they're educated. That's why artisans are at the forefront. They create the strike, really, in the early modern period. It's artisans. It's skilled craftsmen. And just in 2 minutes, why does this happen? Why do artisans suddenly start seeing themselves as a class apart? Why do they start targeting capitalism as a structure and the state as doing them injustice? Why? Well, there are really two reasons that one can give. One is that what happens because of the French Revolution to craftsmen in Germany, in parts of Italy, and in France, is that it opens the doors and the guild protections are gone. Anybody can be any trade you want. Laissez-faire capitalism, you want to be a plumber, you can be a plumber. You want to be a tailor, you can be a tailor. And so all of a sudden, in Paris in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, there's all sorts of wagons being pushed through the street with beautifully made clothes on them, going for practically nothing, because there's so many other tailors making suits. And the price, the wages these guys get, Marx was right about that, insofar as his assessment of wages, artisans are making less money. Their world is falling apart. They have the dignity, they have the skill, they have the knowledge, they have the organization in friendly societies, which at a minimum give you a decent burial so you're not dumped into some pauper's grave. And they're mad because who let all these other people do the trades that the guilds had protected? And the other thing that happens is, goes back to where we started, industrialization and mechanized production. That if you go to a market in Reims, since I used that example before, or anywhere you want, in Aubenas or Privas, n'importe où, you can go there and you can buy a suit off a rack. You can just go and buy a suit. And you don't have to pay somebody a lot of money to make your suit from beginning to the end. And it's cheaper. So who does that hurt? It hurts the artisans, the craftsmen. And so what happens then? Aha! Somebody with money says, hey, you guys are all tailors. You're not doing so well, are you? Things aren't real good. Well, I'll tell you what. I will pay you to make pants cuffs. I don't know much about suits, as you probably gather. I will tell you to make pants cuffs. Do you make pants cuffs? I guess you have to. Or to make, sleeves on a jacket. And all I want you to do is make 100 sleeves on a jacket. You make the left ones, you make the right ones. And I'll pay you. It's just like domestic industry before. Are they mad? Of course they're furious. And they go out and strike, but they lose. And you can strike in France after 1864. So that's what happens to them. Or let me give you another example from good old Limoges. In Limoges, you know, plates. You got plates. And plates had always been, beautiful plates had been hand-painted. Renoir, the painter, he started life as a porcelain painter. And that's what made it a quality item. If you find painted Limoges plates from the 1880s, you hang on to those babies and don't put them in the microwave. So then what happens? So somebody invents a process where you can put like a decal on a child's toy onto the plate and bake the decal onto the plate between the first and second baking. So what happens to these people who are very talented, who made all this money and didn't hang around, you know, with these other guys who make less money? They are screwed. No one's going to hire them. We'll keep one or two. I once saw a special order that had been done for the Shah of Iran. This was a long time ago. Hand-painted, because he wanted to hand-paint it. But that's the end of that. And they ended up in the warehouse or ended up doing whatever they could. Or glass workers, the same thing. The people that made bottles were very skilled, and they were called Monsieur l'ouvrier en bouteille. They were called, you know, Mr. Glass Worker. And suddenly, somebody in the United States invents a machine that can make bottles, turn out thousands of them, be filled with wine and other things. Who needs these guys anymore? And they go on the road to Belgium or anywhere they can. Nobody needs them anymore. Machine has eliminated them. Are they mad? Oh. And shoemakers, the same thing. These machines made in St. Louis, Missouri, I think, come along and wipe out, you know, certain aspects of shoemaking. So this leads people to think there is something that we can't control out there that is affecting our lives in a very ruinous way. So these people are at the forefront of labor militancy. And in the course of the 1880s and 1890s, they start thinking about, hey, you know, those people that we don't drink with, you know, the ones who load things, carry things around, ordinary workers, maybe they got the same enemy. And then they start supporting their hesitant organizational movements and strikes, and they get together. Now, how did this look from the point of view of, you know, of workers? How do they view what was happening to them? You know, again, we can romanticize class consciousness. We can romanticize this idea of a moral economy, that people ought to be paid for a good wage for a good day's work. And it didn't happen all over the place. But still, it's rather impressive and depressing. Impressive the organization and depressing the view of capitalism and the factory as these units of production get larger and larger. Let me give you two examples how this looked. One, during strikes, what was the image that workers had of their bosses? And what does this tell us? And my friend and cherished colleague, one of the great historians I've ever known, one of the great people I've ever known, Michel Perrault, in France, did work on this, among other of her genius works, the view of the other. In the 1820s and 1830s, when artisans went on strike, you know, they knew the boss, the master. And the boss was somebody who, you know, they'd see and all that, and they'd see him around, but they're kind of mad at him, so we're going to withdraw our labor for a while. We don't, you know, you ought to pay us more. You know, you ought to be the guy you can be. You ought to be the guy you can be and pay us a just wage. Well, the master, you know, he has pretty good relations with them. He may, you know, like the noble in Toulouse. He may, around Toulouse, he may give them a chicken on Easter or something like that. But he's somebody recognizable, and he's paternalistic. But this time he's gone wrong. So we're going to go out on him. We'll blacklist him and all that. What about the 1850s and 1860s? Why, that is very different indeed. The 1850s and 1860s, if you look at the vocabulary of people on strike, that they still know the boss. They say to the boss, but they call him a lech. He's a lech because he hits on his female workers, often with some success. He's gross, or he eats too much, or he drinks too much, or he beats his wife. They're personal characteristics. In the kind of language, the gestures, and the la parole, the discourse of strikes. And what about the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century? It's transformed completely, particularly in big factories, because something has come along to change the way people view their own work experience. And this is called industrial discipline. Industrial discipline. And the strikes, then the boss is often in Paris sending telegrams to Limoges saying how they should deal, they being the foreman, deal with the workers. He has become a symbol of capitalism, defended by the army of the state in the view of militant syndicalists, militant union people who had the right after 1881 to organize. He is a symbol of the structure of a large-scale industrialization that they can't control. And he is off, you know, in his chateau, on his boat in Normandy or something like that, but he has been, the voice of him is now the foreman. And the foreman enters the game. Enters, not the game, but enters the workshop. And he represents the attempts to impose industrial discipline on people whose parents or even them had always worked at home. And you worked when it was light. Or you worked when you had done nursing your baby, then you worked. And when you wanted to go for a stroll to have a smoke or have a drink, you did that. But the foreman puts up regulations that you will be fined if a plate is broken, you'll be fined for chattering. There was a horrible fire in Brooklyn that killed 140 women who had been sort of locked in about 1910 or 1911 because they were chattering. They were going out in the back to instead of working and talking, and so they all burned to death. And the regulations told them that you will be fined if you do this, you'll be fired if you do this. And the person that enforces them is the foreman. The foreman is promoted from within or increasingly brought from the outside to impose industrial discipline on these workers. The Wedgwood pottery manufacturer, some of you have heard of that, he once said very prophetically in 1807 or 1808, he said, what I want to do is I want my workers to be like hands who move and who act and who react to the commands of my brain. And they will do what I want them to do. So the factory, and this is in England too, is, you know, if you can think of assembly lines, I used to work at Kellogg's of Battle Creek. I did the raisin bran. I put the raisins into snack pack. You know, I did that. And I worked at Alice Loves Jams and Jellies in Portland, Oregon. And all this, and we hated the foreman, I'll tell you that, we just hated them. So at least I could hate them. I don't hate them, but I did hate them. I'm sure I hated them. Of course we hated them. But it's the foreman are the people who put the regulations up, who punish you for trying to be yourself, who trying to leave to see your friends. And then the foreman, they create these factories as a way of imposing industrial discipline. When you see, and that's not the only reason, because you need factories for big machines. These machines, I can never figure out how to work them. I worked in a canning plant. I was supposed to work this machine. I could never figure out how to work it. It would get jammed all the time, and I'd always get in trouble. So it's all coming out now. But what they do is when you have workers wanting to have their pictures taken, when you have cameras, you know, and when they're taking their pictures together, like a football team or like a baseball team, they're always in front of the door of the factory. Why? Because there are very few doors, and there's a clock over the door. And it's now the clock, it's the siren that tells you when you can come and go. Not when you're hungry, not when your baby needs to be nursed, not when you just had it to hear with breathing dust and know you're going to get TB and croak from that, in lots of places. And that's what imposes this industrial discipline comes from, from these foremen. And so strikes are often against foremen. There was a strike in Limoges of women workers who were forced to kneel down and pray before the workday, and they strike against women foremen too. Now, not all of them were egregious, but nonetheless, this was a way of them, a way of viewing their experience was shaped by the necessity of being at one place at one time, and if you're not there, see ya. That's the end of that. You better be there. And imposed industrial discipline inside the workplace. I did a film for a documentary for FR3 on Limoges, on the strikes in 1905, and we did part of it. It was 100 degrees, literally, it was 41. And we did it. We did it in the ruins of the Haviland factory with dead pigeons and plates, and the door wasn't there anymore, but I'd seen it before, and you could feel what it meant to these people if they had their pictures and they said goodbye to comrades who had been fired, who had been let go because there wasn't enough money. It was pretty bad. So the industrial discipline, attempt to create this kind of perfect workforce, what it does is it creates resentment, and it helps explain, there are other reasons too, but this kind of mobilization of ordinary people. Now let me just finish with the following story, because this is an amazing thing, and a few of you in other courses have heard this, but I tell it because it was prophetic. It was again this wonderful historian Michel Perrault, when she wrote an article I published in a collection of essays a long time ago called The Three Ages of Industrial Discipline. And it parallels the view of the other, where you're against the guy's trying to, the patron's trying to get you, the patron's trying to get you to produce this plate and this stuff and these shoes and all of that. And then pretty soon it's the foreman that tells you how many things you're going to do. But what happens at 1900, at a time when the Olympics start, and you're counting how far, or restart, how quickly you can run the 100 meters or whatever. And an engineer called Taylor, Taylorism, an American, comes up with a way of measuring productivity by counting the units that you can produce. How many little god-awful bags of boxes of Raisin Bran could I produce in so many hours? And they count them. And if you don't count enough, you're out of there. If you don't have enough. We weren't unionized. We couldn't be unionized then. You're out of there. And what happens, Taylorism becomes very important. Ford loves Taylorism. And the car producers, Renault, embraces Taylorism. It's just an unbelievable thing. And there's one story when a Taylor or some French engineer comes to an American company and says, all the workers are young here. This was a Taylorism place. All the workers are young. Where are the old ones? He says, come along. We'll have a smoke in the cemetery and you'll see. And Michel Perrault predicted in 1978 that the kind of surveillance or the kind of counting of the assembly line production would give way to what she called an amazing thing. Think about our post-industrial world of the cubicles of people answering phone calls and doing computer line work will give ways, the way you measure performance and create industrial discipline will give way to what she called beautifully the quiet violence of the computer. And it did. See you on Wednesday.